Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about an infamous chapter in Oklahoma history. On New Year's Eve, 1939, near Hugo, Oklahoma, a white sharecropper's house goes up in flames with three murdered victims inside, the Rogers family. The police first identify the suspects as being work release inmates with ties to the family through gambling and bootlegging. A confession is reported in newspapers. Yet several weeks later, a black man is charged with a crime, a young farmer by the name of W.D. Lyons. It becomes readily apparent that his confession was coerced. A state investigator openly bragged that he beat the confession out of him. Yet, he's convicted, despite the efforts of a young NAACP legal defense lawyer by the name of Thurgood Marshall and Stanley Belden, an Oklahoma ACLU lawyer. Conviction, the murder trial that powered Thurgood Marshall's fight for civil rights, tells the story of the case and trial, and a larger story of how the case galvanized support for the Legal Defense Fund, which helped the NAACP and Marshall challenge a whole host of unjust laws, which ushered in a new era of civil rights. My guests today are the authors, the father-son team of John and Denver Nix. They'll be speaking and signing the book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Tulsa County Bar Association at 15th and Boston. John and Denver, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Rich. Thanks for having us.
Rich, pleasure to be here.
This is an important story that has sort of become lost from Oklahoma history, mostly forgotten. What led you to tell this story?
I was reading the biography of Thurgood Marshall by Carl Rowan, and I read the one by Juan Williams. Both of them referenced briefly the trial of W.D. Lyons, and there was brief description of the involvement of the NAACP in that case. And the statement was made, I never could figure out what happened to W.D. Lyons. And I thought, well, I'm right here in Oklahoma. I should be able to figure out what happened to W.D. Lyons, maybe. So I set out to do that. And one of the things that I did was go to the archives in Oklahoma City, and I was able to locate the parole board records, and that included documentation of both the parole of W.D. Lyons and the pardon, and there was a letter in there from a lawyer that said that he would guarantee Mr. Lyons a job if he were released in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. I had a long-standing relationship with Bishop Thomas Smith, pastor at a North Tulsa church, and he was from Okmulgee, and following week he got a hold of me and said, John, I found his widow. So at some point, not too long after that, I went down, spoke with her, and she took me out where W.D. was buried, and that, you know, spurred my interest.
And then my dad and I, when I was in college, my dad and I started talking about the case, and we'd, you know, stay up late nights as he was thinking up this book idea. My dad put together that the Lyons case happened at the same time that the Legal Defense Fund was founded. And the Legal Defense Fund, of course, being the sort of pivotal entity that eventually tried the Brown versus Board of Education case that desegregated America's schools and led hopefully someday to the desegregation fully of American society.
Right.
So my dad did, you know, put together that this case that was sort of lost to history was pivotal in the history of the Legal Defense Fund, and that's the history of civil rights in America, and started kicking the idea around of doing this book. Talk about it often when I came home, and when I was living in Washington, D.C., I'd go to the Library of Congress, because it's free, of course, and discovered that at the Library of Congress, they have the NAACP records there, and I located the records of the Lyons file, the Lyons case, and found this really rich archive of correspondence between all the players, including, most importantly, in my view, W.D. Lyons himself, which is one of the things about this story that really drew me in and, to me, makes it come alive, is that we have, you know, correspondence from Stanley Belden, one of the attorneys, from Thurgood Marshall as a young lawyer, long before he was Supreme Court Justice or Solicitor General, sort of early in his career, Thurgood Marshall. But most importantly, we have correspondence from W.D. Lyons himself, the defendant. And you can see his personality and his life kind of come alive in a way that is often not true for civil rights history stories. And
basically an indigent defendant.
Indigent defense stories, exactly.
Yes. Well, the story is of a New Year's night slaying of a sharecropper family in far southern Oklahoma, Fort Towson, just about a little ways from Hugo, the Rogers family. Husband and wife murdered. So what happened, and how did the suspicion eventually settle on this young man who had been out rabbit hunting?
Well, so on New Year's Eve, 1939, just outside Hugo, Oklahoma, as you said, it's a snowy night, a waning gibbous moon, and there is a heinous murder, a really gruesome murder of a man and a woman, and their child burned alive in the home. It's a, you know, it's an axe murder, and a shotgun was involved. Their house set afire, so everybody in the community sees this home aflame in a barren field. And that is not the sort of thing that happens in Hugo, Oklahoma in 1939, right? I mean, it was an extraordinary event that made headlines all over the state and the region, in fact. It seems as though the people responsible for that were some white convicts on a chain gang nearby. But the fact that there were men on this chain gang who were probably responsible became a pretty serious political problem for the political establishment in Oklahoma, heading all the way up to Oklahoma City. So the governor wanted to find a young black person to pin the murder on, and settled on W.D. Lyons, who had been out rabbit hunting in that area nearby that evening. And our book is the story of his trial.
Yeah. Now, those convicts from the chain gang, it was basically a work farm.
Chain gang is...
It's a work farm.
Yeah, it's a general term, I think, really referring to a work gang, because that's part of the problem. They weren't chained. They were running, apparently, a pretty loose operation.
And it's interesting, Bob, there was a biography of Bobby Bluejacket, who's a notorious person here in northeastern Oklahoma, and it's a huge, exhaustive book, and it talks about how Jess Dunn, the warden of the Oklahoma prison system, would create these work farms in which he really sort of trusted these inmates. They were trustees and really trusted to the point where they could walk down the center of town. And I guess this story sort of points into that, that little towns were fed up with convicts basically having the walk of town.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in our research for this, we, you know, spent a lot of time down in Hugo and in Fort Towson around Choctaw County, and found elderly people down there who remember that time, and remember trustees in these work camps kind of having the run of town. One guy used to hold a church service on Wednesdays. He was a preacher. And, of course, they were running wildcat or illegal whiskey. I mean, of course, all whiskey in Oklahoma at the time was illegal.
Yes, it was dry.
And it does seem that Jess Dunn was a very confident – he was very confident in his own abilities and in his relationship with inmates. It wasn't too long after this entire episode took place that Jess Dunn was killed himself in a shootout that took place in connection with an escape, and you probably know that story. But yeah.
But it's interesting is that they actually had a confession. There was a purported confession from one of the people from this work gang.
That's right. There was a confession made, reported in the newspapers widely. This is a time, and as a journalist, especially interesting because you see how deeply involved in the investigation the reporters were, and frankly respected in their community. One longs for that time. There was a confession made that was in the newspapers, widely read about in that community, and a number of corroborating witnesses came forward. All of this very public, which is part of the reason why when the state finally, after going through weeks of investigations and all this evidence coming together around the trustees in this camp, suddenly the state settles on this random young black farmhand named W.D. Lyons as the man who committed the murder. People in the local community were sort of befuddled. It had become clear by then who committed this murder to people reading the newspapers in Hugo. Of course, what the governor of Oklahoma was concerned about was not just the Hugo community. He was concerned about all of the voters around the state, and didn't want to be seen as responsible for allowing this murder to happen via the lax conditions at the work camp.
Yeah. So at that point, they settled on W.D. Lyons. Apparently, he'd been taken into custody very quietly, no publicity at all, and literally coerced into making a confession. That's the short of it, right?
The authorities also chose a co-defendant, or maybe compelled Lyons to help them choose a co-defendant, the fellow with whom he had gone hunting.
And that was Van Bezel. He's taken into custody. He's given bond, and he disappears.
He's told to get out of the county and not come back.
So this was very much, I mean, this becomes suspicious as you're
right.
looking back at the
he
records.
He ultimately was. I mean, he was charged, given bond. He had a lawyer representing him. W.D. Lyons did not. Bezel appeared at a preliminary hearing, as did Lyons. Bezel had counsel, and it was at some point after that preliminary hearing, apparently, that he was told to get out of the county. And that becomes apparent later in the story.
Which is, of course, very, very suspicious. One of many things about the early investigation that doesn't add up and leads us to believe, as we state clearly at the beginning of the book, that we believe W.D. Lyons' account of events to be the truth.
One of the significant things that happened was that Lyons was held in the jail in Choctaw County for more than a year before he was tried. Now, that doesn't seem odd if you think of it in the context of our current judicial system. We hear about that all the time. But back in those days, in 1940, in southeastern Oklahoma or anywhere in the South, if a black man was accused of a serious crime, he typically was put on trial pretty quickly. And if the most heinous murder to have occurred probably in Oklahoma, but certainly in that area, you would expect he would be tried almost immediately. And
especially
that wasn't
the
case.
With a confession.
Right. You have a confession, you'd expect him to be
tried. Whether it was coerced or not.
Yeah. He was held in jail for 12 days after his initial arrest, and throughout that time and at various times he was beaten and coerced. I've read some since my first involvement in this book about how coercive confinement can be, particularly in the basement of a jail.
At one point,
in the dark.
At one point before the second confession, which was taken at McAllister at the penitentiary, they left him in the room with old Sparky, the electric chair.
another interesting episode.
It was a fascinating, and of course, all of this came out at trial. Mm-hmm. The state's investigator was openly bragging in the streets of Hugo and at the hotel that he had coerced the confession with the use of a blackjack, which he had a horrible name for it. Mm-hmm. And he said, I beat him until I got the confession out of him. There were numerous people that had that this came out in court during the case. And yet, he was still convicted. My guests today are John Nix and Denver Nix, a Tulsa attorney and his son, a wonderful journalist. They're the co-authors of Conviction, the murder trial that powered Thurgood Marshall's fight for civil rights. And they're our guests today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk a little bit about some of the principles. Thurgood Marshall comes to the case. Another interesting part of this story is a man whose name is lost to history, Stanley Belden. He was the ACLU representative for Oklahoma, really almost a tragic figure in his own way. Roscoe Dungy, the head of the NAACP in Oklahoma. These three men, I guess, arranged for Thurgood Marshall to come to defend W.D. Lyons.
That's right. The Roscoe Dungy was, as you said, head of the NAACP and became aware of the case. He was the first person who arranged for Stanley Belden to represent Lyons. The reason he chose Stanley Belden is that Stanley Belden had two key qualities. He was, for one thing, willing to represent clients other attorneys would deem undesirable. He had made a career representing Jehovah's Witnesses unwilling to salute the flag, representing communists and socialists in Oklahoma who, have, you know, of course, if you know much about Oklahoma history, you know that at that time, Oklahoma was rife with socialists. There was at one time more socialists in Oklahoma than any other state in the country. And he was willing then to take W.D. Lyons on as a client, and the other characteristic being that Stanley Belden was white. And Roscoe Dungee felt that they needed a white attorney to go down to Choctaw County to represent Lyons, lest the court not take him seriously or something worse happen to the attorney they sent down to represent him. Dungee also saw that there was some value in this case and started, he had a pre-existing relationship with Thurgood Marshall and wrote to Marshall about this trial, and they started talking about getting the NAACP involved and about the potential for garnering some headlines around it. So Thurgood Marshall, at this time, a relatively young attorney, relatively early in his career, he'd just become the head of the legal defense fund at the NAACP, is looking for a case which they can use to get some headlines and raise some money. They're having a really hard time keeping the lights on, month to month, just barely making it through. Marshall sees the potential in the Lyons case for that reason. Not to say that he wasn't driven also by a sense of justice. He absolutely was. But this is 1940 Oklahoma. The NAACP is getting numerous requests every day from indigent African Americans who are indigent and innocent African Americans under the thumb of the criminal justice system across the country. And they've got to make decisions about who they represent somehow. So that's part of the reason that Marshall chose to get involved in the case.
Now, John, you've read the trial record. It's pretty amazing the jury came up with a guilty verdict, except the fact that it was the South. It was a black defendant accused of killing a white family. Can you maybe talk about some of the things that stood out to you from the trial record that came out that would normally lead a jury to acquit?
Well, first of all, faced with a confession and confusing references to an earlier confession that was suppressed, the jury, all 12 male white members of that community, no doubt were left with compunction about what they had to do, but I think probably a consensus that it had to be done, because somehow, and we could debate why that happened, there was not a great deal of evidence about the other confessions and the other possibilities. So I think the jury, based on the evidence, probably thought they did the right thing, but they didn't bring the death penalty. They didn't suggest the death penalty, which leads almost anyone cognizant of the times, the racial attitudes, with the conclusion that there had to have been serious reservations about his guilt.
Now, a lot of the stories of the coerced confessions that appeared in court was outside of the jury's view, correct?
Right. And, yeah. I think readers will be, first of all, impressed with the way the judge conducted the trial. My expectation when I first turned the page was that this is going to be a kangaroo court. I was impressed that in 1941, the judge down in Choctaw County conducted a trial that was pretty darn fair in many respects. And he held that hearing outside the presence of the jury.
And that's where you heard about
much of this evidence was discussed.
And that's where you heard about the torture.
He suppressed that confession. What ultimately becomes apparent to the jury is this confession. And although there were not supposed to be references to the earlier confession, as often happens in trials, that little dam holding it back was washed aside, and all this other discussion comes in. It had to be kind of confusing to jurors who were trying to sort this out. But the separation in time between the last beaten confession and the one recorded in the office of Jess Dunn up in the prison in McAllister, that 12-hour interval was determined by the judge to be sufficient to remove the taint of the previous coercion, the beatings. And that became the issue on appeal in Oklahoma and then to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And it sounds like both the attorneys for W.D. Lyons thought that they would prevail not only in appellate court here in Oklahoma, but certainly at the Supreme Court.
That was not
the case.
Stanley Belden and Thurgood Marshall were not necessarily confident that they would prevail in Choctaw County, but what they were doing was trying to create a record, establish record in the court that would set them up to win on appeal, because Thurgood Marshall had just recently won his first Supreme Court victory, the Chambers case, in which the court threw out a coerced confession. So it seemed very clear that though they may lose in southeastern Oklahoma if they got this case on appeal, they would ultimately prevail. That, of course, was not the case. And in the United States Supreme Court, shockingly for Thurgood Marshall, he had his first loss. And Deputy Lyons subsequently spent over 20 years in prison.
Now, it's really interesting, though. Even though that happened, what you found in the course of your research was that this was not a town arrayed against W.D. Lyons. In fact, most of the residents of the town knew what was going on. In fact, they were, it says this was an issue that sort of united white and black in Hugo at the time. They knew that this guy was getting a raw deal.
Well, you'll see that one of the witnesses who testified favorably to W.D. Lyons was the father of Mrs. Rogers, who was killed in the crime. He subsequently became the chairman of the NAACP group in Choctaw County.
And that's a part of the story as well, is how this case sort of helped fuel the rise of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Inc., which became the powerhouse that fueled civil rights cases in the federal court system. My guests today are John Nix and Denver Nix, father and son, Tulsa attorney and journalist, and the co-authors of Conviction, a new book about a story of Thurgood Marshall's coming to Oklahoma to represent W.D. Lyons in far southern Oklahoma. It's a really interesting book of Oklahoma history. I have to ask, though, after the last part of the book features a lot of correspondence in the wake of the trial conviction. And there is one piece of correspondence that I found was really telling that you write about, but you don't actually include in the book. And this is a bit of correspondence in the spring of 1941 between Stanley Belden, who at this point has been destroyed by this trial. He's getting out of the law entirely. He's getting out of Oklahoma because the state has literally destroyed his legal career. And it's a piece of correspondence between Belden and Thurgood Marshall, in which it appears there are people at the state feeling out whether a payoff, they could find a technicality that would reverse the conviction, and then they wouldn't retry him.
Right.
That's the gist of it.
There's an offer that seems to have been made to Stanley Belden that if the attorneys representing W.D. Lyons would agree to say that Judge Childers was out of the county when the jury was deliberating, that the whole case would be thrown out.
Now, this technicality, yeah.
This happens just before the case goes before the Supreme Court. So it's clear that the authorities in Oklahoma have had enough of this. It's become very embarrassing for the political establishment in Oklahoma that this case happened. This man was tortured into confessing. They think they're going to lose in the Supreme Court. And it seems that this offer was proffered. There's some indication that the offer may include, you know, if you guys will say that Judge Childers was out of the county while the jury was deliberating, which is a physical impossibility. You couldn't have made it to the county line in the hours that the jury was deliberating, probably. But if you'll say that, and if you'll kick us a few bucks here and there, I mean, a bribe, then we will let W.D. Lyons out of prison, basically. We'll throw the case out. We'll drop the whole matter. The correspondence, the most significant piece of correspondence about that is not reproduced in the book because it's a handwritten note by Thurgood Marshall in which he says, essentially, forget that, no compromise.
Yes.
That raises this ethical quandary because there is no indication, although the offer included some suggestion of a bribe and a suggestion that the attorney that, you know, they'd have to agree to something everybody knew wasn't true. There's no indication that anybody ever asked W.D. Lyons what he wanted to do about it, whether he wanted to accept their offer.
It seemed to be a case where they put the cause before the client. And I wanted to ask John about that. What did you think when you guys discovered this note?
Well, it wasn't until sometime after the discovery of the note that I gave it any consideration, because mm-hmm. Denver was the one that found that. But when we did talk about it, I was impressed with the fact that here was a serious moral quandary. One way of looking at it is that lawyers faced with this sort of offer could rightly just turn their backs on it, because it probably involved their participating in what would amount to a crime. It apparently, after the offer was not taken up by Belden and Marshall, the amount that would have been required went down. Seems like maybe there was a point in time where the prosecutors would have been willing to just drop this thing if they could have had anything in return for it. We don't really know all the details, of course. Too much probably was undocumented in the first place, and whatever documentation there was, other than what we've discovered, was lost to time. But nevertheless, case went beyond that. It was on its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. One of the important things that people might benefit from understanding in reading this book is that when it was appealed to the Court of Criminal Appeals, the determination was made that sufficient time had elapsed between these confessions, so the second confession would be admissible. It wasn't tainted by coercion. The U.S. Supreme Court was really considering whether or not the requirements of due process required in the 5th and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution had been met. They did not themselves look into the factual background. They, in a manner of speaking, were observers as far as the facts were concerned. Their only concern legally was whether or not due process had been afforded to Mr. Lyons, and they found that because the Oklahoma court had considered the matter, that was sufficient to have afforded him due process as those amendments required. Because I think maybe this case wouldn't have been decided the same by a Supreme Court today, or even 10 or 15
years later. Yeah. So I'm wondering what your takeaway from this journey was as far as this story and why it's important.
Thurgood Marshall, of course, went on to become one of the most important, in my view, the greatest Supreme Court justice in American history.
Certainly one of the most important litigators in American history, too.
Absolutely. That's very well put. One of the most important litigators, certainly. A transformative figure. W.D. Lyons is kind of a sacrificial figure, because though things did not end well for him, and I think there's some evidence that the outcome of this case weighed on Thurgood Marshall's conscience for many years after, and certainly shaped his view of criminal justice in the United States. The case itself was extremely important in a historical context. It seems that when Thurgood Marshall was down here for the Lyons case and he was going around speaking in local communities, one of the things he did is talk to a classroom of students. And one of the students in that classroom was a woman named Ada Lewis Sipwell, who later, having been inspired to become an attorney by that visit by Thurgood Marshall, agreed to be a plaintiff represented by Thurgood Marshall, suing the University of Oklahoma for admission in the now famous case of Sipwell versus University of Oklahoma, which was, again, a key building block in the road to Brown versus Board of Education.
Yes, it was. John and Denver Nick speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa about their book, Conviction, the Murder Trial That Powered Thurgood Marshall's Fight for Civil Rights. They'll be talking and speaking about the book and signing the book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Tulsa County Bar Association, 15th in Boston. That event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher.